Path Projects. Hey, you know, we found the perfect Christmas gift. I know this is playing after Christmas, but there's a lot of birthdays out there, and there's, you know, you really don't need an event to give a gift.
And a gift should last longer than a day or two anyway, Scott, so yeah. It's appropriate.
Well, we decided to give some of our favorite people, including Andy Jones-Wilkins, one of these Path Projects Pyrenees hoodies. And we were just talking to finishing up a podcast with Andy, and he started just glowing about it. Tell us about this Pyrenees hoodie and why you like it, Andy.
Oh my goodness. First of all, you know, I've loved the Path Project stuff for a while now, the shorts and the underliner and those things. But this Pyrenees hoodie is like off the hook. It is literally like putting on a baby's bottom. It is so soft. Bear with me here. It is so soft and so snuggly. It's got this perfect fitting hood with a little thing that comes up your neck. It's got the little hand things where you can put your thumb through. And even, get this, on the left side, a double hole that you can see your watch through. I mean, these guys have thought of everything. Right. And I was just telling Don and Scotty just before, I don't have mine on right now. And the only reason I don't is because I was cooking dinner for the family last night and I got a little bit of stuff spilled on it. And I was like, oh my God, I can't let it stain. And I put it in the wash and I put all this stuff. It's literally in the dryer right now. I can't wait to put it back on after my trail run this afternoon. And it's just literally like being hugged by a baby's bottom. It's so soft and so smooth and so comfortable. Path Projects, thank you so much. And thank you guys for sending it along. Don't tell my family this, but it was my best Christmas gift.
I wish you could see Andy as he's describing this. He's hugging himself.
Hey, so there is a lightweight and a medium weight. Yep. You have the medium weight, and the lightweight is just as great and fantastic.
Nice for spring running, right. cool summer mornings.
So either way, you're in good shape. That's pathprojects.com.
All right. We ready?
Yeah.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
What are you, balancing your checkbook over there, H.A.W.? What's going on?
Yeah.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right, we ready?
Well, yeah. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Trail Runner Nation. This is Andy Jones-Wilkins.
I'm Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And this is our year in review episode. Not sure if it'll be playing in 2019 or at the very beginning of 2020, but I twisted these guys' arms into doing a little year in review episode because 2019 has been quite a year. What do you guys think?
Well, it absolutely has. A lot of things happened. And looking back, preparing for this, Scott and I went through like a week's worth of tutoring for this particular episode. And there's a lot that happened, AJW.
Mm-hmm. Not the least of which was a 20 plus hour podcast of Western States.
Yes.
that the two of you guys did in the Auburn Running Store. Are you recovered from that yet, by the way?
I still have a blister on my thumb.
I don't think it was your thumb. I think the ending comment was, where is the preparation H? I think that was caught on air with you, Scott. But it was a lot of fun because we weren't alone doing it. We had a lot of help out there. And AJW, you hosted the golden hour with a phone in your hand and you were on the track and it was just a lot of fun. And we look to do that again.
Intentions are there.
Of course, the best line of that was, AJW, turn the volume on and turn your phone sideways.
No, I don't think it was turn it sideways. I think it was turn it around.
Yeah, turn it around. That was it. Yeah, turn it around.
We've seen enough of you.
We've seen your shoulder.
No one's interested in seeing you.
We've seen your shoulder enough. Okay, kick us off. What happened? Line us out here. Are you doing this chronologically? Are you doing it male, female? How are you laying this out for us?
Well, what I thought I would do is just talk a little bit about some of the runners this year and some of the things that have happened in the sport, and maybe we can kind of dip off of that. Why don't we start with women? That's appropriate.
Yes.
And the Ultra Runner of the Year, the Performance of the Year, and then one of the categories I like to bang around from time to time is the Rookie of the Year. Yeah. Sort of thinking ahead of who might have done a couple of things this year that kind of caught my attention and might be worth looking at in the future.
Well, that's good. Let's start off.
Well, hey, my female. Go ahead.
Before we start that, let's talk about Ultra Runner of the Year. This is explain what that is. It started with Ultra Running Magazine, right? And there's a few voters, judges, participants. How does that all work?
Yeah, so Ultra Running Magazine, the paper print magazine, which has been around since the early 80s, you know, it used to be six sheets of paper stapled together in some guy's, garage, has been doing a ranking of the top runners of every year and the performances of the year and age group awards since that time, since the early 80s. Tropical John Mettinger currently organizes the group, and there are about 30 panelists that are representative of race directors and other journalists in the sport and people in general like myself who just have a passion for the sport and are fans of the sport. So what Tropical John typically does is every year around mid-December he sends out the ballots to all of us and gives us about 10 days to return those ballots, and then he tabulates those votes, and then the magazine publishes the results sometime in early mid-January. So some of these categories are directly from my ballot, and others like Rookie of the Year and Most Inspirational Person are just me and the kind of thinking that I have about the year.
And it's not too late to subscribe to the magazine and get that issue. It's quite an issue.
No, it's not. And you know, through it all, through this burst of technology and the way in which technology has kind of taken over a lot of print media, Ultra Running Magazine has persisted as just the source of information about ultra running and race reports and really good content, really good writers, monthly columnists, and so forth. So it is a great magazine. I feel privileged to have been included in the voting for the last 10 or so years. And each year when I receive that email from Tropical John, I get very excited about sitting down and filling out my ballot.
So female ultra runner of the year, that's where we're going to start. Who do you have on there?
Well, you know, for me, it's interesting. I have over the years been somewhat outspoken in
really?
Yeah. Right.
Thank you, Captain Obvious.
Right. Okay. Yes, indeed. I have been somewhat outspoken in my contention that DNFs should be included in the consideration of an ultra runner's body of work. And yet this year, in determining my female ultra runner of the year, even though Courtney DeWalter had a DNF at Western States, she was running in the lead all the way down to the river crossing. And as she was making her way up to Green Gate, her hip just was crying out and she was forced to drop out. Notwithstanding that DNF, I had to vote her as the female ultra runner of the year. Her UTMB mm-hmm. performance was just yep. incredible. Her other races in building up to Western States and her recovery from her injury at Western States was just too much to ignore. And so Courtney DeWalter is my female ultra runner of the year.
And for a lot of good reasons. Not only is she just a great runner, but just a great personality and a great person and a great ambassador for the sport, someone to put out in front and have others take a look at it. But I'd like to pose this as part of the thought process. Maybe the fact that she decided to take herself out of the race at the river at Western States makes her ultra runner of the year because she made a great decision. She learned, listened to her body, and said, you know what? If I continue pushing this, then it's going to take me out for the rest of the season. She made a smart move. So, you know, I tip my hat to that ultra runner of the year, making a good, solid choice, even though a DNF occurred.
And I will say, we've had her on the podcast, and one of the things that I really admire about Courtney is the way that she trains by feel. Mm-hmm. You know, she's very disciplined, but when she leaves the door, you know, she admits that she doesn't know how long she's going. She doesn't know whether she's going to be doing hills. She may have an idea, but it could turn into something completely different than the plan that she had when she left the door. And I really, really admire that.
I loved that podcast, and it was maybe 2 years ago now when we had her on, but what she spoke about, you guys were asking, you know, oh my gosh, you must have some structured training program, you must have, and she just laughed and she was like, nope. You know, I walk out the door and some days I turn left and some days I turn right and some days I go for an hour and some days I go for 5 hours. And I found that so refreshing in this age of kind of meticulous training, and that she kind of just goes on what she feels. And that's just wonderful. I think it's great. She's a great model to a lot of us.
And I was going to say, she also, if you recall, AJW, she took the grit score test.
Oh, yeah. 4.4.
That's right. 4.4. That's right.
Yeah. And we got to understand from her perspective how she scored on the grit score, which I was surprised it wasn't higher. She gave herself a little bit of room for improvement there.
You know, I think one of the things about learning to listen to yourself on a training run lends to learning to listen to yourself on the actual race day, that checking in with yourself and listening to how you feel and what you need is a skill practiced all through training, you know, Monday through Monday, not just race day.
Yeah. And, you know, with respect to Courtney taking that DNF, I'm reminded of the speech Craig Thornley makes every year before Western States. And it's essentially a speech about, you know, there's no heroism in finishing at all costs. We're all going to eventually take a DNF. And I think once you've done that, once you realize that, you kind of know the difference between finishing because you want to gut it out and finish. Maybe your quads are shot, but you know you can just walk it in because there's enough time under the cutoffs, versus potentially running, as Courtney did, would have potentially running 20 miles on a compromised hip that could not only affect the rest of her season, but perhaps even the rest of her running life. And I think being able to make those decisions, I think, are really important to ultra runner's life.
Now, behind that speech that Craig, the race director, gives at the beginning of the race, he might just be protecting the budget for belt buckles.
That's true. There's no doubt that there's a part of that. You know, Craig is always conscious of budget. You know, female performance of the year, this was a fascinating category for me. So I'm going to mention three. In third place, I did put Courtney's UTMB, which was a fantastic race. And one might wonder, you know, how could there possibly be two performances that would be better than Courtney's UTMB? But in second place, I put Maggie Guterl's overall win at Biggs Backyard Ultra. For those of you unfamiliar with this is Gary Cantrell's race in Tennessee, one of those last man standing races where they do a 4.1 mile loop starting every hour on the hour. And this year, Maggie Guterl from Durango, Colorado, but formerly from Pennsylvania, won the race outright going for over 50 hours, I believe. And that was just an incredible performance. But number one had to be Camille Herron's 24-hour world record at the IAU 24-hour world championship. We know that Camille last year had broke the 100-mile track world record, and this year followed that up with a 24-hour world record. So it's always interesting when you get a couple of performances of the year that don't necessarily match up to the ultra runner of the year. But in this case, with Camille, and Camille's been ultra runner of the year before, but in this case, her world record just stood head and shoulders above the rest.
AJW, what makes Camille such a great runner? When you think about Camille, what are some of her attributes that allow her to be ultra runner of the year and hold the world's record?
I think she just has a metronomic style of running. She just is very, very committed to her pace, to what she does. I don't know a whole lot about her training, but it's got to be consistent. It's got to be high mileage. And so when she toes the line at something like a world championship 24-hour race, she's just ready to go. And those those splits or those quarter mile splits, those mile splits, those 10K splits are just, they're just, it's, you could set your watch by them. And I think that's the kind of mundane repetition that is so necessary to have success in those long, particularly those long track races. Her success on the trails, you know, she's had good days and bad days out on the trails. I think she's still learning, you know, what she can do out there. But, you know, I think eventually those will come. But in the meantime, something like, you know, picking off these world records that have been held by Ann Trason, of all people, you know, are, that's big company.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Andy, have you ever done a last man standing race?
I have not. I have not at all.
any interest in that?
No, none whatsoever.
and tell me real quick, I can't remember, what is the course like? It's a 4.1 mile loop that they start every hour. What is it like? It's not on a track. Is it a trail run?
No. So at Biggs Backyard Ultra, it's really unique. There are two different routes, both that are 4.1. I actually think it's 4.16 miles, and to be exact. And they and Gary has a daytime loop and a nighttime loop. The daytime loop is all on trail, moderately rolling. I think some of it is kind of double track, but most of it is single track. And they go around that for the 12 daylight hours of the first day. And then they switch to a road loop for the nighttime hours. And then they switch back to the trail, and then they switch back to the road. So I think Gary was particularly concerned about safety, or perhaps it's slowing down in the evening on the trail. But most runners will finish those loops between in the early going between 40 and 50 minutes, sometimes as long as 52 minutes, and then they'll have that, you know, 20 minutes, 10 minutes, 8 minutes to rest, and then they'll head out again.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with how the strategy that some of those runners put together out there. But what would you do, AJW, and Scott, to you as well, if you've got an hour to do the 4.16, do you hustle up a bit to give yourself some rest time? Do you try to make it so you only have 10 minutes left just to take care of some necessary business? How would you pull that off? Or would you stagger it? Would you alternate a little faster loop and a little slower loop? How would you execute such a race?
Well, it's interesting. I've not done a race, but I have one of these last man standing races, but I have coached some people who've done it. Mm-hmm. And I at least in working with those people, the key is to use those first couple of loops to determine what a comfortable pace is that you can run that loop in. So if you can get around that in 43 to 45 minutes, let's say, and not have a tremendous amount of energy output, you know, maybe doing it in a heart rate that's very comfortable, then maybe you sort of set your watch at doing 43 to 45 minute loops and having that kind of 15 minute recovery period during which you're taking in calories, you're getting off your feet, you're managing your, you know, whatever you need to do with your shoes or your clothes or if weather comes in and so on, and then kind of set a tone, maybe take an average of your first 4 to 6 hours and then try and hit that average for the next 6 hours and then sort of reboot that for the evening part where you're on the different loop. And then, of course, when you get into 24 and 36 hours, you're dealing with sleep deprivation and can you get in a 5-minute power nap and so on and so forth. So I think the strategy evolves in the sort of 6 to 12 hour chunks. I think that's what I would do were I to ever try to do one of these.
Scott, I think we're getting closer to having AJW do one of these.
Yeah, sounds like he's thought about this a little more in detail. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so that's performance of the year, top the three that you had for performance.
All right.
Of the year
so
for
then
female.
next up, this is a category I like, and I've done this every year in my own rankings that I do on iRunFar, and it's called the Rookie of the Year. And the Rookie of the Year category, I kind of made this up myself, but basically what the Rookie of the Year is a person who has come on to the ultra scene this year. And prior to this year, maybe they ran an ultra or two, you know, maybe some local races, but they weren't necessarily on the radar of the national scene before that. And for the purposes of this, I use as my litmus test Anton Kupichka's 2006. And for those listeners who've been around for a while, you may recall that in 2006, Anton literally came from nowhere and won the Leadville 100. In a really fast time. And people were like, who is this guy? You know, this naked guy running through the mountains. And so for me on the women's side, Madison Hart, who won, you guys might've known, she won the female race at the Tahoe Rim Trail in one of the fastest times ever. A couple of other races. She came from a ski background. She spent some time in Bozeman at Montana State, a recent graduate of Western State University in Colorado. She really is someone who bears watching and was my rookie of the year this past year. You know, to go in and run your first 100, or that wasn't her first 100. She had done Javelina too, and the kind of wheels fell off when she ran Javelina in 2018. But to come into Tahoe Rim Trail, not an easy course, and bust out one of the fastest times ever there as a 22-year-old, I thought, this is my rookie of the year.
That's an amazing time. And at 22, there are so many lessons to learn out there. You wonder how you can pick up efficiency and effectiveness. And there's a better word for that somewhere. It's I don't know what it is, but AGW maybe have it. To be able to put it together at 22 is really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know many 22-year-olds who've succeeded at that kind of a distance, transitioning from a sport like alpine ski racing. Surprise of the year. So when I say surprise of the year, it's not necessarily a surprise to me, although it could be a surprise to me. It's really more of, you know, somebody that may not have been on the radar of the ultra running media, someone who may not have been on the radar in a big race. And in that context, I had to go with someone we had on the podcast back in July, and that's Brittany Peterson at Western States.
Right.
You guys remember when we had Brittany on. Brittany had done a couple of hundreds before. She's coached by Paul Lind, the son of legendary doctor from Western States, Bob Lind. She was kind of under the radar going into Western States, you might recall. I think some people thought, oh, Brittany could maybe do top 10. And yet by the time she got to the river, she was hot on the heels of eventual winner Claire Gallagher. They both knew and heard that that Courtney was suffering up ahead, and that the race was likely going to come down to the two of them. And she ran that race like an absolute veteran. And I would venture to guess that not many people had Brittany Peterson in the top two at Western States when they filled out their Western States prediction form a couple of weeks earlier.
Well, she came with a lot of experience from her boyfriend that knew the course real well. The Lens have been around this sport for forever. I remember Bob.
Absolutely.
Bob Lind. In fact, at the onset of Western States, he was the doctor out there and writing down heart rates and blood pressure at different aid stations. He really set off the research that's been so prevalent at Western States and unique, because they've done a lot of studies out there through the years and feature a different one each year. And I really think there is a treasure of information there if we can ever unlock that chest and open it up and talk about some of the studies.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's the thing. Brittany, even though she lives in Idaho, she kind of had a home court advantage, you know, with Cody Lind, the grandson of Bob, with Paul, the son of Bob. It's almost like, you know, one of the first families of Western States, and they were basically pushing her on down the trail. So that was, I think, a surprise to many people.
And my apologies to Cody for not getting his name. I should have known that. So sorry about that, Cody.
So you got Cody. Yeah, well, it's hard to keep track of all the Lins, but of course the patriarch is Bob, and then you got Paul, and then you got Cody. I want to go to my most inspirational, because I don't do that by gender. I have one most inspirational runner of the year. And in past incarnations of this sort of exercise, names that are familiar to the podcast, Dave Mackey, the year after his leg was amputated. I've had Tom Green, was the original Grand Slammer as most inspirational. These are people who just through either their running or perhaps what they've done in the world outside of running just inspired me, and I think inspired the running world in ways that are worth noting. And this year, my most inspirational runner is Amelia Boone. Amelia Boone actually came over from ultra running, from obstacle course racing. In fact, was a world champion obstacle course racer for over a decade. Is a full-time attorney. And this past year, and from her career in ultra running, in obstacle running combined with ultra running, she actually ran 100 miles at Biggs Backyard Ultra this year before she dropped out. Good friends with Maggie Guterl. Amelia, around in the early fall, came forth with a disclosure that she's battled eating disordered eating for her entire life. And this was before Mary Kane spoke about her what had happened to her under the Nike Endurance Project mm-hmm. with Alberto Salazar. And Amelia was very forthright in talking about her daily battle with eating disorders and the way in which it's impacted her life, the way it's impacted her running, the way it's impacted her professional life as an attorney and and with her relationships. And I just found it to be so inspirational. And the fact that she was using what is a really influential social media platform to shine light on her daily struggle with eating disorders really, I think, changed the dialogue around this issue, particularly as it relates to female runners and everything that comes after it, the potential illnesses, the osteoporosis, the potential depression that emerges from it, the social, emotional, and mental illnesses that emerge out of disordered eating. Amelia just did a wonderful job of bringing that out, and she continues to sort of share her story with the world and I think inspire hopefully a next generation of women runners, you know, to avoid what has happened to her.
Hey, AJW, I want to go back. I agree with you and good for her for having the courage to be vulnerable and share that and knowing that it's probably going to help many, many people. I want to ask you this question. We've kind of gone through the female list here. If you were Maddie Hart's coach in 2020, what would you tell her to do? What advice would you give her?
Oh, man. I think we've now seen a fair number of young phenoms, both women and men, come into the sport and leave quickly. Mm-hmm. And then in recent years, we've seen others come into the sport and in a measured way, find a way to stay in the sport. So the first thing I would tell her is to try to follow in that latter group. I think our sport does come with a fair bit of pressure, whether that's, you know, unwritten pressure that might come from sponsorships or early success or more obvious pressure of people saying, oh, sign up for a golden ticket race, qualify for Western States, run Western States. And I would ask her to really listen to the voice of reason. She's 22 years old. She's got the whole life ahead of her. She had incredible success at Tahoe Rim. I would say listen to that voice inside and listen to the voice of those elders in the sport and perhaps look at those women in particular with long careers, the Megan Laws of the world, for example, who we've had on the podcast, and kind of take the long view. At the same time, and this is a careful fine line, I might also say to Maddie, you know, grab the brass ring while you have it. If an opportunity comes up for you to run a race you've always wanted to perhaps travel internationally to run a race, don't put too much pressure on yourself, but take advantage of the exuberance of youth, the advantage of the fact that you have, as a young athlete, the opportunity to recover more quickly than an older athlete. And so find that fine line between jumping in with both feet to this sport, because what we found is when these youngsters come into the sport, they're like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. There's all these cool people. There's all these great places. There's all these wonderful races run. But sometimes they do so to a fault. So it's a matter of finding that balance.
Has she been sponsored yet? I'm not aware.
I'm not aware of sponsorship for Maddie. I really don't know.
How critical is it to be to have a sponsor to be able to compete on the big stage like that?
I don't know. I mean, I think for people to be able to travel internationally, I think sponsorship certainly helps in paying the bills or perhaps getting some kind of an athletic, some kind of financial support to help with entry fees. I mean, it's a balance, right? When you're older and perhaps you have a little bit more discretionary income, you're not fast anymore. When you're younger, you don't have a lot of discretionary income. You kind of need that support. I mean, I know Craig, for example, has spoken to athletes who've had, you know, are struggling to pay the entry fee to Western States. You know, they're sponsored athletes. They've made it. They're in the top 10 year after year. So I think sponsorship does help on the financial side of things. I think there are times it comes with pressure. And I think it's a matter of the athlete determining how they're going to balance that pressure with the financial need, the opportunity that they might have. I mean, some athletes might get enough sponsorship that they could go from a full-time job to a part-time job that will allow them to train more. But I think the past in ultra running is littered with people who've gotten to that point where they've been able to quit their day job. All of a sudden, they train themselves into the ground, and next thing you know, they're out of the sport. So I think there's a fine line.
To your point, grab the brass ring while you can, because to stretch that out over a decade, which you can easily be competitive at 32, even 42, we've seen athletes out there, to stretch it out for a decade is very, very difficult. So grab that brass ring while you can might be good advice.
I agree. It's a balance. It's a balance.
All right. So we back to the ultra runner of the year male.
Okay, yeah. So let's go back up and this was interesting. So you've got, you know, Jim Walmsley. I'll tell you right now, Jim Walmsley is my ultra runner of the year. He has now been, assuming he wins the magazine award, and that's an assumption. This is just my vote. I'm only 1/30th of the poll. But assuming he wins, you know, he'd be a third consecutive year. In many ways, you know, perhaps as dominant ultra runner on the male side we've had since maybe Tom Johnson, Scott Jurek, Tim Tweetmeyer. So, you know, he's established himself. And yet this year, you know, you had a group, Zach Bitter. I would imagine it's going to, I have Carl Meltzer and Carl's a voter as well. Carl Meltzer and I typically go back and forth after we've filled out our ballots and turned them into Tropical John. We sort of compare notes on our ballots and Carl, you know, put Zach on his top spot. And I think there probably would be others who will put Zach at his top spot. We're going to talk in a little while about the JFK 50, because that's where my surprise of the year comes in. But I think Zach Bitter, had he won JFK 50, perhaps gotten close to Jim Walmsley's course record there, could have, you know, maybe even gotten a few more votes at number one. We'll see how the voting plays out. I had Jim number one and Zach Bitter number two. Pretty close because Zach's performance at the 100-mile world record indoors at 6 days at the Dome was just an incredible performance. He went on to get a 12-hour world record because he just had to run a couple more, half an hour or so more to get a 12-hour record. You know, that was incredible. It bears mentioning my third place male, who was Patrick Reagan. Listeners may be familiar with Patrick Reagan. Patrick Reagan had some splits at Western States from the river to the finish, which are some of the fastest splits that race has ever seen. You know, we no longer take a split at the Highway 49 crossing, but I would guess he hit the Pointed Rocks aid station and ran from there to the finish in 48 minutes. So assuming he made it from Highway 49 up to Pointed Rocks in 7 minutes, he probably tied Jim Howard's iconic 55 minutes from Highway 49. I can see you guys rolling your eyes already. Here goes AJW. You know, talking about splits and you're, you know, I'm not, but that was incredible. So, And Patrick Reagan had a second half of the season where he won Javelina 100 and then ran something like 12 hours and 30 minutes at a flat 100-miler in Texas. So that men's Ultra Runner of the Year was incredibly competitive, and I think we haven't heard the last of any of those three guys. But Jim gets the nod this year once again.
Well, three times in a row is pretty amazing to be dominant and have a performance outstanding to take the whole field is amazing.
You know, and I was surprised we actually met with Jim Walmsley at the lottery and talked to him a little bit on the broadcast that we did for Western States there. And surprisingly, he's not coming back to Western States. As a winner in 2019, he's elected to train and try something new and go to Comrades. What do you think about that, Andy?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I spoke with Jim literally on Sunday at the track after, you know, the day after the race, and he said that then. He said, "Nope, I'm going to take a year off from Western States and I'm going to go to Comrades." And, you know, I think anybody, and Jim is an incredible student of the sport, right? And really, really respects the history and tradition of the sport, and in fact gives back a fair bit. His presence at the lottery, for example, is a great example of him giving back to the sport, and you'll see him pop up as a volunteer at races. You know, I think for anybody who knows anything about ultra running, you know, as much as we value Western States as our sort of de facto national championship here in the United States, Comrades Ultra Marathon in South Africa that gets over 10,000 runners a year and has been in existence for decades and has some of the most legendary running performances in the ultra running world has ever seen. You know, for somebody like Jim, it's got to be on his list of things to do. And while some immortal runners like Andreessen could pull off a double and run Comrades and then 10 or 12 days later run Western States, I think Jim is smart enough to realize, you know, he can find his way back to Western States eventually. And he wants to put his heart and soul into that. I think, too, you know, he has a United States marathon qualifier time, because he ran a 104 half marathon last January in Houston. So I wouldn't be surprised if he puts a bit of energy into road training over these next 6 months and really gives a win at Comrades a try, which, by the way, opens up the door to a host of other runners like Patrick Reagan, who I spoke about earlier, and one of Jim's training partners, Jared Hazen, who ran an incredibly fast 14-hour and 20-something race at Western States this past year. So I think it adds a lot of intrigue into this year's Western States, and good for Jim for not looking at external pressures and saying, nope, you know what, I'm focusing on this incredible race in South Africa that has been on my list for a long time.
You know, we get accused by ourselves mostly, because I don't think anybody else is listening. But we talk a lot about Western States, but let's just talk about times and how they're dropping. It wasn't long ago that if you ran a 17-hour Western States, you were going to go back next year because that was fast. But now 17 doesn't get you anywhere close to an automatic bib for the next year. Times have really moved down. And for you to speak about, you know, Jared Hazen at a 14:20 something, really? I mean, 14:20 and you don't have a cougar.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, what, I mean, it takes that long sometimes.
In every other year of the race, he would have won. Yeah. I mean, it, running away with it. So, I mean, you gotta pull for the guy going into this year's race, right? You gotta pull for Jared, and who knows? Those guys train together. Probably have Walmsley pacing them.
Oh yeah, that's not good for the field. For the field, it's good for them.
How about performance of the year, male?
Well, how can I not take a 14:09 Western States course record, breaking his own course record? Yes, it was a relatively benign weather year, but it was a pure course. Jim ran off the front himself. Jim's course record at Western States gets my performance of the year. Now, I've already gotten skewered online for not giving Zach Bitter. How could I not give a world record 100-mile run my ultra runner performance of the year. And I just, and this is not Western States or trail bias. My feeling is that the number of people, the pedigree of the people who've gone after the course record at Western States is every bit as significant as the pedigree of the people who've gone after the 100-mile world record. And the fact that Jim not only beat it, he beat his own course record, but he beat it by a significant amount, just said to me that was absolutely the performance of the year. And while there are some people out there who think Jim is going to potentially come back and beat it again, I don't think so. I think this Western States course record is going to go be on the books for a long, long time. I think the planets are not going to align quite like this again with a runner at the top of their game with conditions that are perfect. I echo that Ellie Greenwood's 2012 Western States course record and Jim Walmsley's 2019 course record. Those two course records, they were lightning in a bottle. You had a runner at their prime in perfect conditions, and I don't think they're going to be broken for a long time. And in that, I would just have a bad taste in myself. It would give me a stomachache and probably make me puke if I didn't give them the performance of the year. But Zach got second.
Hey, either way, you are going to get skewered online. You know that, yeah. Right? Because that's the nature of online.
You know, right. one of the things we were just talking about a week or so ago is – you know, the dominance of some of the runners in some of these races. And again, to Don's point, forgive us for talking too much about Western States, but it's just on the top of my mind because it's a local race here. You know, the Tim Tweetmeyers, the Scott Juricks, the yeah. Ann Traysons. And we don't know whether that's going to happen, not only at Western States, but a lot of these different races, because the field has become so competitive. A Tim Tweetmeyer could have, not had his best day or had stomach issues and still was able to pull off a win at Western States. That doesn't happen. Everything has to be right. You have to be at the peak of your training cycle. You have to come in uninjured. You have to have, all the stars must align for you to take a win at some of these competitive races like Western States or UTMB or Comrades or whatever. What do you think about that? Are the dynasties over?
Oh, now there's the question.
Well, Jim and Courtney are in many ways a dynasty right now. I mean, if the voting plays out the way I expect it, you know, both of them would be repeaters. I think what would more likely impact the quote unquote dynasty is the fact that, you know, it's not all about Western States. That we get, you know, Craig would be the first to say that the most competitive ultra in the world is UTMB. It's not Western States. And so, if you want to be the most dominant ultra runner in the world, you go to UTMB. Now, you could probably run Western States also. But I think the parity that exists when you get, especially at the shorter distances, when you get, say, at the, Lake Sonoma or the North Face 50, at least what used to be the North Face 50, or even some highly competitive 100Ks, you're going to get, anybody could win on any given day. So I think the parity in the sport could spread it out. I think here we are on the cusp of 2020. It'll be interesting to be, look 10 years into the future. Will there be a multi-time Ultra Runner of the Year? Will Matty Hart play it smart and all of a sudden be Ultra Runner of the Year from 2024 to 2028? Maybe so. Will some other person we haven't heard of yet, coming over from the roads or coming over from a cross-country ski background or coming over from a hill climbing background, take the sport like Walmsley has? I think it'll be interesting. Because, the Sawchuk 7, the staying alive for 10 years, I think we're seeing a pendulum swing where we're not getting quite as much burnout. I think the first half of the decade saw quite a few runners come and go. I think the second half of the decade, we're seeing a little bit more staying power among some of these athletes who kind of come onto the stage and stay. So I don't think the dynasties are over quite yet.
I'll submit this thought for consideration that the dynasties are going to be tougher because there's more competition. The field has grown so much more. Not to take anything away from Ann's 14 wins at Western States. But you really can't see that happening again with all of these influx of just great athletes that are coming in. It would be very difficult to pull that off again.
Yeah, I can't see it happening either.
Yeah.
Okay, we are to rookie of the year.
Men's rookie of the year. This was a really challenging category, but you guys might remember coming into Western States this year, there was a little bit of a buzz about this guy Matt Daniels, who was a sub-4-minute miler in college. And a little bit of research suggested that he might be the first sub-4-minute miler to run Western States. We know we had some, you know, sub-220 marathoners and some really fast road people. But this guy, Matt Daniels, was coming in. His ultra resume was pretty slim. He came out of nowhere and won Black Canyon 100K in February. That got him his golden ticket. He ran one more 50K in Oregon. And won that, and then got fourth place overall in, get this, 15:21 in Western States for fourth place overall. Prior to that, he had done the Pikes Peak 30K and a small 50K in Bend, Oregon. And next thing you know, he just was getting fourth place at Western States and running a 15:21. And mind you, he's like 10 feet tall.
It's like Chewbacca running.
So he steps over some of the summits there, right?
So Matt Daniels certainly got my rookie of the year. And I remember chatting with him at the breakfast after the race, after Western States. And I said, Matt, that was an incredible race. I think most of the people who kind of have been around the block for decades were like just waiting for the wheels to come off. And they never did. You ran that race like a veteran. And I hope you come back for a long time coming. So, you know, along with Jared and Patrick Reagan and some of the other guys who are licking their chops because Walmsley's not in the race this year, Matt Daniels is in that, and he will not be a rookie anymore. And he's a relatively old rookie. He's 31 years old, but, you know, he was spent his 20s running fast road times and track times, and now I think he's on the trail scene, and he's here to stay.
You don't often see a sub-4-minute mile type of body transition over right to an endurance sport.
No, you really don't. You really don't. And I remember there were some guys doing a movie about him, doing a film, and it's a great little film, and they interviewed me after the pre-race, and I was skeptical. I have to admit, I was like, how can a 4-minute miler, you know, be disciplined enough to run a smart race at Western States? And I mean, it turns out he was, you know, I had egg on my face because he was plenty disciplined. And I mean, 15:21, woof, that's flying.
Yeah,
interesting. How was he not your surprise of the year? Did you think he was in there?
He's not my surprise of the year, because going into JFK 50, you know, the iconic race, oldest ultra run in the United States, you know, started on the urging of John F. Kennedy back in the early 60s. Every prognosticator out there was picking Seth was picking Zach Bitter to win. Zach was traveling out here. He was primed. It was perfect for him. All he had to do was bide his time on the Appalachian Trail section and then just bust it out and you know, finish the thing and hopefully give Jim Walmsley's 5:21 record a run for its money. And lo and behold, this kid Seth Ruling from Chattanooga, Tennessee, with some high bib number, comes out in shorty shorts and a small little 12-ounce bottle, running the thing like it's a road race. And he wins the thing in the fourth fastest time ever. And no one saw that coming. No, I mean, except maybe Seth's, you know, training group in Chattanooga, Tennessee. That absolutely had to be the surprise of the year, even more surprising than Matt Daniels. Interestingly enough, in thinking of these two guys, they could have each won surprise of the year and rookie of the year, but I had to share the wealth a little bit. So I gave Matt the rookie and gave Seth the surprise. And different than Brittany on the women's side. Like, Brittany's surprise was, you know, people knew who she was. Nobody was saying, who is that Brittany Peterson? They were saying, who is it and can she pull this off? At JFK, they were literally saying, who the hell is that guy? And that happens often at JFK, but the guy ran off the front like Steve Prefontaine, for goodness sake. And talk about the Chattanooga choo-choo. He was rolling, and that was my surprise of the year. So quite a year for surprises, quite a year for rookies. And I think it sets us up nicely for an interesting, 2020. It'll be interesting, for example, if Seth decides to throw his hat into a golden ticket race or something like that, or comes out west and runs Lake Sonoma or another fast 50 or 100K somewhere. Just like it'll be interesting to see what Matty Hart does in 2020. So I like to see these rookies. And by the way, these rookies and these surprise runners, over the years, I've done this now for 9 years. I mean, some of the people who've won this award before are, Sage Kanaday and Claire Gallagher and Taylor Nolan and Timothy Olsen, believe it or not. So these are people who were kind of off the radar, and now they're on. And I imagine you'll see, we haven't seen the last of Brittany and Matt and Maddie and Seth.
Hey, I want to, we often talk that in our culture, in our group or community, that the trail is a personality in the community. What have you seen this year, AJW, in 2019? How has our community or our sport changed? And I'll give you two: one for the good, one for the bad. How has it changed in 2019? What have you seen?
You know, here's something that I was thinking about on a run the other day, and I don't actually know if it's true or not, but it's something that has been at least in my universe. I can't think of a high profile or even medium profile cheating incident this year. Mm-hmm. I think the last couple of years there have been a couple of things, some course cutting here or illegal aid outside an aid station there or muling in a race, kind of buzz about cheating or is there, or drugs and things like this.
Or somebody hanging out in an outhouse.
Or hanging out in an outhouse. Yeah. But right, I haven't, and again, maybe it's just me, but I can't think in 2019 of a cheating incident, whether it was cutting the course or something like that. And maybe that's a sign of good things to come, because you all know our community polices itself pretty well. I mean, I'm the first person to kind of overreact, frankly, when I see or hear about these things, and guilty as charged to that, by the way. But it's been a relatively quiet year on that front. So I'm hopeful for on the good, that this is a good sign that perhaps there is that the culture has won and that the honor system pervades the sport of ultra running in a way that perhaps it doesn't in other places. In the context of what we've talked about now for a decade, the growth of the sport and the commercialization and the sponsorships and those types of things, has it dirtied the sport? And at least in this way, I don't think it has dirtied the sport. Here's where my worry is, and I've talked about this for a while, and you guys saw it at the lottery, where you were earlier this month, and the attention paid to how many people don't get in and how much pressure Craig Thornley and the Western States board face in kind of managing that lottery. I'm seeing a barbell in the sport now where there's kind of the haves and the haves nots, a handful of races that are so incredibly popular, that are so in demand that everyone wants to have on their bucket list as soon as they enter the sport and run Joe Schmo's fat ass 50K. The next thing they want to do is sign up and be in Western States, versus the small local, you can sign up the week before and join in and get a taste of the community. I'm worried that in the midst of some of those big high profile races, we're losing the grassroots core events of the sport. And you are seeing a fair number of kind of race directors burning out, of permitting pressures becoming greater, particularly races that are on public lands where the permitting pressures have become more significant and the race directors have said, screw it, I'm not doing this anymore. So I hope that we get to some happy medium where those mid-level races, whether they're big time 100-mile races or nice small cozy neighborhood 50Ks, continue to thrive and have the ownership that they need. I mean, it's interesting to look at Ultra Sign Up and compare the races that always have a lottery and people have to plan 6-8 months out versus the races that you can sign up the day of and just walk up to the starting line and run. And I hope that those can survive financially so that they can continue to succeed. So lack of cheating incidents is the good, and a little bit of a worry about the sustainability of the mom and pop races is the sort of bad.
Hey, Andy, are there any mom and pop or upcoming new little tiny races that have caught your eye, that have you excited and maybe have on your to-do list this year?
Well, you know, I've moved from Virginia to Arkansas, and what that's opened up for me is just this incredible race environment of the South, of the Southeast United States, that there is a part of the country, for whatever reason, maybe it's the culture of the region, but they really love the sort of down home, have a campfire, hang out after the race sort of environment, everybody doing trail work, everybody sharing the trails. And you see a lot of series down there in the Southeast that are kind of similar to James Varner's series up in the Northwest, or Jamil Curry's series in Arizona. So I'm kind of getting interested in these mom and pop series where they might even be sub ultra distances, mm-hmm. right? Where someone can do a 30K or a 25K or a trail half marathon. So, you know, a couple that come to mind: the Rough Trail 50K in Kentucky. I ran the Blood Rock 50K, which also has a 100-miler associated with it in some really rugged terrain in Alabama. In fact, Jeff Browning came out and ran the 100-mile distance at Blood Rock in Alabama. You wouldn't think that you could have a technical, you know, race with over 23,000 feet of climb in Alabama, but you really can. So those are the kinds of things that I would encourage people to look at. We talked about Ultra Running Magazine earlier. Go to the Ultra Running Magazine calendar and just throw in, you know, your state and look for the races that are there. They seem to be popping up all the time, and a lot of them have really good race directors that are incredibly responsive. You can send them emails, they'll email you back. I just love where that's going in the sport. Well, we all want to get into those races with the lotteries, but there's so much out there, and I'm seeing it kind of come alive in my little part of the country. And you see it here. I'm currently visiting my son who lives here in Durango, Colorado, and there's a lot of that kind of stuff here, where little sub ultra trail runs where you can just go out on a Saturday morning with a bunch of like-minded people and just have a great race. So that's where my hope in for 2020 is, that those mom and pop shops continue to thrive.
Yeah, I just recently ran a race. It was 50K Twin Peaks. Ryan Spitz is the race director out there, and he's putting together that Untamed California that's 330 miles long. That was such a great course and such great volunteers, and your fellow runners were just, as you would expect anywhere you go, just awesome and amazing. So, and there was no lottery to get in there. So there are great races out there that you just have to go put yourself in, and you'll discover why that race director said, "This is my favorite training course. It needs to be a race. I just got to put something together." And you've been a race director yourself, AJW. You know the drill.
And it's hard work. It's hard work being a race director and corralling volunteers and managing the permitting. It's tough.
Now, we may have caught you off guard, but that's kind of our style. Do you have any predictions for 2020? Because sometimes we do the prognostication. AJW's predictions for the next year. Do you have anything on top of mind?
I have a prediction in the context of, I think we're going to, first, this is related to kind of gear and preparation, and it kind of relates back to our podcast we did with Carl Meltzer. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had this pendulum swing from minimalism at the beginning of the decade, right, to what could only be referred to as maximalism now, you know, with people packing their drop bags and their packs with, you know, everything in the kitchen sink. I think we're gonna see a pendulum swing back in 2020, people being a lot more careful about what they drag around the course, and we're going to see that happen in races as well. We're going to see more minimally marked courses, more expectation of race directors that runners know the course. You know, not that they're unmarked courses, but that because of the impact that these races have on the environments, whether they're state parks, federal lands, county parks, I think we're going to see a little bit of a pulling back of this overmarking and over prepping, maybe fewer crew access points at races, you know, where you get these traffic problems, parking problems. That's what I hear race directors talking about all the time. They typically don't have any issues with the runners or with their volunteers, but overcrowding at aid stations with parking or crews getting speeding tickets and them running afoul of the law, those kinds of things. So that's a prediction I think we'll see on the sort of gear race environment side. I think on the runner side, I think we're going to continue to see racers get smarter. And I don't know if this is because of coaching. I don't know if this is because of some stories of overtraining in the past. But what I think we'll continue to see is racers choosing their race schedule. This is on the elite level, but possibly even trickling down. Choosing the number of races they do carefully. Choosing when they do an all-out race. Choosing even whether or not it's a day for them. And maybe deciding to pull back and just get it done. I think we're going to see an increase in the sort of smart factor, and I think that relates to nutrition as well. All the joking about stomach and vomiting aside, I think runners are getting smarter with their nutrition. I think nutrition companies are realizing that, you know, if they get the chemistry right of their particular products, that people are going to buy them. And I think we'll see that trend continue in 2020 in smarter races.
Boy, I have a couple comments that you look back to the times a few decades back when some numbers were put about out there, like Jim Howard's number and these iconic runners, they were doing it with very little technology, very little nutritional, science inside the bottles and the packaging. They just went out there and just ran fast and hard, and things worked for them. That's amazing. Now, the other comment I had, as you mentioned, course overmarking, and I've thought about this, and I think I've talked to either on the podcast or certainly on the trail about some of the tools like Candace Burt is using at her 200s, which is the Gaia program and the maps that are available on your phone, and having less marking and relying more on what you can just see. You can physically see where you are and where that trail is. It's a nice tool, and so I don't think you need a ribbon every quarter mile and holding your hand through the entire course. So
in that context, is it a requirement of the race for them to load it on?
Yes.
To the phone?
For the 200s anyway. No.
Not to have the Gaia. It's a requirement to have the spot GPS locator. But as a runner of one of her 200s, you don't have to have it on. That's an option.
Well, I'm the last guy you should ever ask about any requirements.
But I do think that could be actually smart, though. You know, if you were to just say, for example, I know at UTMB you're required to carry a phone. I don't think they're specific about what kind of phone, but you are, and it's interesting. I haven't talked to race directors about this, but one could see a future where you could have everybody loaded, have the course loaded on everybody's device, and you wouldn't have to mark the course at all.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And you think of the way that would minimize impact. You would have less vandalism of the course, and so I mean, it's a big leap, I think, to go from where we are now to there. But I could see that. Heck, you could have Siri telling you, hey Siri, do I turn?
you could blame Siri.
Well, and Don, if you're sitting by the side of the trail questioning your own, sanity, you could talk to Siri.
I believe I have.
You have this nice soothing voice, Andy. There's a left turn coming up in 300 yards. I actually like that. I joked with Don the other day. In fact, I took a picture and sent it to him. I was out on one of our normal trails, and it was being set up for a race that weekend. And there were no exaggeration. There were like 7 ribbons within 50 yards on a trail where there were no offshoots. Right. I mean, you couldn't make a mistake unless you fell. And there were like seven ribbons. It was crazy. Anyway, this has been a fun year. We've enjoyed this year. We've learned a lot. We've seen a lot. And we've been inspired by a lot of great runners out there. And
hey,
thank you.
Does this mark, Don, I remember, I think it was the 2011 lottery that you were launching this, or was it earlier than that?
Oh, what TRN?
Yes, TRN.
TRN. We just finished our eighth year.
That's what I thought. Yeah, because we were leaving the lottery in 2011, and you said, "Hey, I have this crazy idea for a podcast. Would you ever, you know?" And yeah, 8 years. Well, you know, it's so interesting because that does parallel my column on I Run Far. My first column on I Run Far was October of 2011. So it's 8 years. And I think you guys started right around December of 2011. So here's to 8 years. And man, it's a lot of content there. I think you have something like 450 episodes, don't you?
A little more than that. Yeah.
Scott keeps that record. But I remember asking if you wanted to do it, and you said, no, that's clearly a bad idea. that'll never work.
Hey, and if you haven't checked out Andy's column on I Run Far, go do it. He does an article there every week, and you can learn a lot about different kinds of beer, too.
Yeah, Megan Hicks reminded me, she's the editor at I Run Far, that I've written 418 columns for them. I just can't believe it. So my wife keeps telling me I've got to take a sabbatical and write a book. One of these years I'll do that.
I thought you were writing a book.
Well, I am, but it's kind of like anybody who's writing a book. I was focused on it for a couple of months, and now it's been about a year. So,
and also a coach at CTS. We had Jason Koop on the podcast the other day, and he's such a smart coach, and he's gathered other smart coaches like yourself to be included on that team. And whatever your needs are, a particular race like Western States, you can pick up AJW, or whether you're going for a different type of 24-hour track meet, he's got people lined up.
Last man standing race.
He's got the right people.
One of the nice things about CTS, if I could say this, is that the group of coaches, I think there's seven or eight, they represent a wide range of demographics. Coop might have told you, we actually have more female coaches than we have women. Male coaches, and a lot of times women athletes are looking for female coaches. So it's a diverse group. It's a group grounded in both the sort of art and science of ultra running, which I think we all know it really is an art and a science. And with Jason Koop as the leader, you know, he's just an incredibly knowledgeable guy. He is constantly learning and constantly improving. It's a wonderful group. I'm honored to be able to work for them. I'm certainly the dumbest guy in the room when we have our calls. I'm also the oldest guy in the room, I might say,
and the most
it's a
opinionated.
Lot of fun hanging out with all these young whippersnapper coaches.
Hey, and Jason has just started his own a podcast, and yep, one worth listening to.
Coopcast.
Were you part of that marketing team and effort to get that name of that podcast, the Coopcast?
I may have been.
and I just saw on social media, Dylan Bowman is also starting a podcast. There's a lot of new podcasts coming out.
A lot of good content
in 2020.
Out there.
And that's what makes some of these events and these records fall, and some successful midpackers and backpackers get it done. It's just passing knowledge along. And whether it's through I Run Far, or it's from podcasts like this, or the ones that are upcoming, they're all just community sharing information.
Yep.
That's good.
So what do you guys, if I could be so bold, what do you guys have on your editorial calendar for 2020?
Ah.
We haven't thought of that.
No, we talked about this on a run.
Not that far.
No, we talked about this on a run, but I don't think we remember what we said.
So does that require some advanced planning? And it's only January. It's only December 30th that we're recording.
Well, you know what? I'm going to throw it out there to make us accountable for this.
All right.
I hope you don't mind. And if you do, you can edit it out.
Okay.
But one of the things that kind of builds on your prediction or your hope for the future is all of these really fun new races that are coming out. And, and we are going to attempt to do a short form podcast that will be in addition to our weekly regular podcast, where we're going to highlight some of these new and upcoming races in a short form, maybe 15, 20 minute podcast, and make people more aware of all these great races out there that, like the one that Don was talking about, that he
Twin
raced.
Peaks.
He had 20 people in that race or something like that.
In the category that we were running in. Yeah, and it needed more than that. And because it was a great course, and running that course, we started thinking, you know, more people need to know about this event. And if they did, they'd do it. And so we want to highlight some of that. And then on top of that, just to jump in front of you there, Scott, is that each and every race has its own obstacle or its own variable that makes it exciting or tough. And whether it's running in cold or running in heat or running up hills or it's altitude, everything has something. And so if we could bring a coach on or that race director and fill the rest of that 15 minutes up with a discussion on how to manage that successfully, that's what we want to do. We want to highlight some races and then put a piece of knowledge with that race.
Well, I would offer this then in that context, because I spend a lot of time, as you might imagine, talking to race directors, mm-hmm. and they are incredible. They are incredible mm-hmm. storytellers, every single one. And for so many, with so many new people coming into the sport year after year, to hear, there's so many that have no idea what goes into putting together a race. And hearing from race directors from around the country, whether it's from that little Twin Peaks Ultra you did or the Blood Rock 50K that I did, the stories that come out of some of these race directors' mouths are just incredible. And I don't mean, you know, the kind of typical stories of, you know, the crazy emails they get of people trying to beg them to come into the race. I mean working with private landowners to try and route the course, or dealing with last-minute course changes because of trees falling, or dealing with it when a volunteer suddenly quits 2 days before a race. I mean, there's so many of those stories that go into what we do. And I think it's unique to ultra running as compared to road running or bicycle racing or things like that. And so perhaps even in conjunction with those sort of short-term 15 to 20 minute pieces, you might get the race director on and chat with them. Because what I hear when people talk to me is, man, I love hearing you on the podcast, and Don and Scotty are so great. And I love it when you guys are just talking about like regular old stuff. And I think that is really what people appreciate. And something like, it may not be pretty, you know, when a race director tells a story of, you know, having to get the porta potty down from where it fell down the embankment of the river. But that stuff happens, right? And people have to do it.
and it gets really exciting when we find out somebody was in it.
Hey, now, it's not always pretty in ultra running.
Right. That's ultra. Hey, so I challenge you next year, AJW, if we're still around, Scott.
Yeah.
If you would come up with race director of the year next year, yeah, as part one of your categories.
Ah, that's a good idea. I will do that.
Or race of the year, or both.
Or rookie race of the year. It can be a whole category, yeah, on its own. Just run right through it. Well, AJW,
you got yourself a deal.
All right. Well, we really, Scott and I really, and the listeners, I'm sure, really appreciate you coming on. And I've often said, you know, if Wide World of Sports ever had ultra running as one of its featured sports, you would have to be the color man on that. There would be no question about it. So
thanks, guys, and hey, I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to be a small part of the Trail Runner Nation. I love coming on. I know in the middle of the year, as I was changing jobs, I missed that Courtney Gritscale one and the interview with Jeff Browning. So sorry about that, but I love coming on from time to time, and you guys got a great thing going, and let's keep it going into 2020.
Well, like the trail, you know, there's no invitation to join a trail run, and there's no invitation for you on this. You have a constant seat here anytime you want.
All right. Thanks, guys.
So go out and run for a year.
Mas.
Mas.